China can now freely interfere in Hong Kong's domestic affairs. And that could, and it could entail lots of different things.
Is China's one country, two systems dead? It's Friday, May 29, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also coming up today, Cambodians struggle under stifling debt, and sports resume down under during the pandemic. That and much more coming up on VOA Asia. China's parliament approved a decision on Thursday to go forward with national security legislation for Hong Kong that democracy activists in the city and in Western countries fear could endanger its special autonomy and freedoms. The United States certified on Wednesday that Hong Kong no longer enjoys a, quote, high degree of autonomy. VOA's Steve Miller spoke with Derek Grossman, senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation, about the implications of this decision.
Well, I think, unfortunately, one country, two systems is irreparably broken at this point, because one country, two systems, which is the system put in place when Hong Kong was transferred from Great Britain to China back in 1997, essentially says that Hong Kong is part of China, one China, but can maintain separate legal and economic systems. And so what we saw in the last few hours with China unilaterally imposing the national security law from its National People's Congress, it creates the conditions in which China can now freely interfere in Hong Kong's domestic affairs. And that could, and it could entail lots of different things. For example, one is that China can now set up agencies, like, for example, intelligence agencies, police agencies within Hong Kong to manage the Hong Kong protesters in the future, or rioters from their perspective. Another example is that Hong Kong's court system now can no longer have foreign judges serving on rotation through their system, which had been customary prior to this national security law being imposed. And so China will now be able to more actively play a role in the selection of those judges. So this really does have kind of fundamental implications for Hong Kong's legal system. And economically, a lot of the problems that Hong Kong may face in the future are going to come from countries that it has been carrying out economic interactions with, for example, the United States. If you look back at Secretary Pompeo's statement, now Hong Kong could also be sanctioned as part of China, whereas they had a they had carved out an exclusion for Hong Kong based upon its semi-autonomous status prior to the national security law's implementation.
Now, you bring up this idea of sanctions. Now, this is coming during the global recession because of the pandemic. It's coming as China's economy is sort of sluggish. We also are coming after this trade war between the United States and China, which resulted in a phase one trade deal. And Hong Kong is Asia's financial hub. So you take into consideration all those things. How effective can economic sanctions be in changing China's behavior towards Hong Kong?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of debate about that. On one side of the debate, there are those who say that Hong Kong is an essential part of China's economy because of all the things you just said. It is a, you know, financial, not just a regional financial, but a global financial hub, and it is part of China. But there are others who say that China actually depends a lot less on Hong Kong these days. In fact, if you look just across from Hong Kong, a lot of the other major cities along the Pearl River Delta there, and including Shanghai, I mean, they far surpass the amount of economic output that, you know, that China would look to Hong Kong for. So there are those who say that trade sanctions against Hong Kong are not going to really make all that much of a difference for China, because Hong Kong, frankly, is not really as important as it used to be to China's economic growth.
So what kind of deterrent actions can governments take against Beijing to change its behavior towards Hong Kong? And the reason why I'm asking this is that China was not supposed to expand its presence in the South China Sea by land reclamation efforts on shoals and building outposts there, but it did, in spite of objections from several governments, including the United States and the other simultaneous claimants in the South China Sea. So what can governments do to affect change in Beijing?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, in the case of Hong Kong, I mean, unless the U.S. in concert with like-minded partners, as you mentioned, like Australia, Japan, others, Canada, perhaps European countries. Unless the U.S. is willing to actually take, action in on the ground in Hong Kong to defend the Hong Kong people from this ongoing crackdown from the mainland, it's going to be very difficult to find any real way of deterring China from going forward.
That was Derek Grossman, senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation, speaking with VOA's Steve Miller. And you can learn much more about this rapidly evolving story at our website, voanews.com. These are some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. China's Hong Kong security law risks intimidating the U.S., say some observers. South Korea sees a spike in new COVID cases for the second straight day. Britain closes its embassy in North Korea, citing strict coronavirus restrictions. And rugby resumes in Australia after weeks of COVID-19 lockdowns. We'll have more on these stories and much more at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA Asia, coming to you from Washington, D.C. U.S. President Donald Trump has offered to mediate in what he termed a now-raging border dispute between China and India. Experts say that the offer is likely to be ignored or met with low interest in both Beijing and New Delhi. VOA's Cindy Sain has more in this report.
Tensions between China and India have escalated after Beijing reportedly moved thousands of troops into disputed territory along their Himalayan border, as expert Jeff Smith explains.
In which Chinese forces appear to have crossed the line of actual control or are in a sort of disputed area between claims of both countries, and set up tents, set up camp, in an attempt to pressure India to stop construction of new infrastructure along the border.
On Twitter, President Trump offered to mediate in what he called their now raging border dispute. But experts, including Smith, don't expect Beijing or New Delhi to accept his offer.
You know, there were a few points in recent years where President Trump offered to play mediator between India and Pakistan on the Kashmir question. I don't think there's anything wrong or offensive about the U.S. offering itself as a mediator in these situations, but you know, past history and current proclivities suggest that neither side really has much of an interest in taking the U.S. up on that offer.
Officials from both India and China appeared eager to de-escalate the situation.
Difference in perception of the line of actual control between the two countries, which has been there for a very long time, and therefore confrontations take place, especially during summers, when there is more patrolling because routes open up. And I take it from that point of view.
And this reaction came from Beijing.
The current situation on the China-India border is generally stable and controllable. China and India have perfect border relation mechanisms and communication channels.
Experts say it is in the interest of both India and China to keep the situation under control and to keep the peace. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
This Asia News update, as if the coronavirus wasn't enough, India is grappling with scorching temperatures and the worst locust invasion in decades as authorities prepared for the end of a months-long lockdown despite recording thousands of new infections every day. Much more on this story and others at our websites, Instagram, Facebook, and voanews.com. And you're listening to VOA Asia. In the closely watched extradition proceedings against Huawei Chief Financial Officer Meng Wanzhou, a Canadian court found that the fraud that the tech executive is accused of by the United States, if proven, would also be criminal in Canada. We have more now in this report from Craig McCullough.
In her 23-page decision, British Columbia Supreme Court Associate Chief Justice Heather Holmes finds the charges Meng Wanzhou is facing in the United States could also be in violation of Canadian law. Meng is accused by the U.S. Justice Department of helping a subsidiary of Huawei break U.S. sanctions against doing business in Iran to be extradited from Canada to another country, including the United States. What is alleged must be illegal in both countries. Meng was arrested at Vancouver International Airport on December 1, 2018, in transit to Mexico. She has been living under a form of modified house arrest in one of her two mansions here in Vancouver. There are currently no sanctions in Canada against doing business in Iran. Canadian prosecutors, on behalf of the U.S. Justice Department, allege that Meng, Huawei, and the subsidiary Skycom committed fraud and endangered U.S. financial institutions. Vancouver immigration lawyer and policy analyst Richard Kirland has been watching the case closely. He says there is still an argument that will be made that Ms. Meng's rights were violated at the time of her arrest. He also says there is still a chance for a Canadian political solution, as the Justice Minister is able to cancel any final decision that would extradite her to the United States.
Canada allows a minister to not extradite a person at the last minute, even though there's an extradition order to return the person to the requesting country. That means Beijing's not wrong here to put pressure on Canada economically, diplomatically, to motivate Canada to bring extradition to an end.
The Canadian justice issued no decision on the admissibility of evidence for the actual extradition hearing. Meng's next court appearance is set for June. Craig McCulloch for VOA News, Vancouver.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This Asia News update from VOA. President Donald Trump has renewed his resolve to, quote, bring our soldiers back home from Afghanistan, publicly questioning again the goal of the current U.S. military mission to the war-torn country. Much more on this story and many others at our website, voanews.com. While many countries in Asia have been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, deep household debt might soon push Cambodia into a crisis as job losses caused by COVID-19 make it even harder for families to repay loans, say experts and debtors. While the country has officially only registered 122 coronavirus cases, thousands of garment workers lost their jobs when their factories closed. Thousands from the tourism or service sectors are also jobless or earning far less money than they were 6 months ago. For some, this crisis could have devastating consequences, including the loss of family land, often a fast track to abject poverty. Hai Sakom, who drives a tuk-tuk, a three-wheel motorized rickshaw, is one of millions of Cambodians who, on average, are the world's most indebted borrowers. Usually his wife and adult daughter sell noodles at a school in Kandal province, but the school closed mid-March as part of measures to contain the spread of the coronavirus. The family lost $10 in daily income. The couple's two sons also lost their jobs in Bavet City when the casinos closed under similar measures to contain the COVID-19 outbreak. The family lost $300 in monthly income the sons sent home. Covering the $400 monthly installments for their $18,000 loan for the new tuk-tuk, home renovations, and the cost of their son's move 6 months ago to Bavet seems impossible. They also must make two monthly payments to microfinance institutions of about $50 each, bringing their monthly total to about $500. One of the sons started a low-paying job as a security guard a few weeks ago, but that did little to alleviate the pressure on Hai Sakom.
How dangerous is COVID-19? 80% of the cases are said to be mild. Young and healthy people are at a relatively low risk. Elderly and people with serious health conditions are at risk of fatality. If you have a cough, fever, and shortness of breath, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
This is VOA Asia. By the end of this week, New Zealand will have some of the world's most relaxed COVID-19 controls. Gatherings of up to 100 people will be permitted starting Friday, up from the previous limit of 10 people. New Zealand has had about 1,500 reported or probable coronavirus infections. 21 people have died. Phil Mercer has more in this report.
Australia's National Rugby League season was suspended because of the COVID-19 pandemic on March 23. The 16-team competition kicks off again Thursday with a match in Brisbane. It's another sign that life in Australia, which has contained the outbreak, is beginning to resemble what it was before the coronavirus crisis. Clubs and administrators have been eager to restart the season for financial reasons, while for many fans, it's another sweet taste of normality. Six venues will be used during what officials have described as phase one of the league's resumption. The stadiums were chosen because they were best equipped to meet biosecurity protocols. Commentator and former player Peter Sterling told Australian television that he's surprised the NRL has been able to resume so quickly.
I thought that it was the height of optimism that 6 weeks ago, May 28th, would be a starting date for us, because we knew that there were going to be so many obstacles. You know, obviously, we've done a great job of flattening that curve and getting it down to a stage where we can start to interact. But that was a long way away 6 weeks ago, so it's been remarkable leadership. And I guess the great thing for our game is the fact we're leading the way.
Games will initially be played in empty stadiums, but the Australian Medical Association has criticised the league's plan to have crowds back by July, labelling it absurd and dangerous. The Australian Rules Football League, another of the country's dominant professional sports, has said its matches will start again on June 11. There is no definite date for professional soccer matches to resume, as the easing of lockdown restrictions, including the reopening of schools, cafes and places of worship, gradually continues. The men's 2020 World Cup cricket competition is due to be held in Australia starting October 18. It's unclear if it will go ahead because of the pandemic. Australia has just over 7,100 known cases of COVID-19. 103 people have died. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The U.S. this week hit a very sad milestone, 100,000 coronavirus deaths. President Donald Trump on Thursday called the mark a very sad milestone. Earlier in the year, President Trump often downplayed the coronavirus threat, saying the number of cases in the U.S. would quickly dwindle to none. But he acknowledged that the death toll, a figure larger than the number of U.S. deaths in the Vietnam and Korean wars combined, in a Twitter comment. Perhaps no place has been affected more heavily than New York, and especially the city of New York City.
Start spreading the news.
I'm leaving today.
I want to be a part of it.
New York, New York.
These vagabond shoes
are longing to stray
right through the
Asia for today and for this week. Thank you so much, as always, for being with us in these difficult times. We'll be here with you next week. We hope you'll join us as well. Until then, take care and be well.